This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
So one is Joanne asked the question at the end of the last year that if passion is so important, at what point does it impinge on other people? At what point does it involve force and violence and all sorts of things that can result from it? And where is that boundary line and how is that managed? The second question that was raised was, Linda raised it, I think, and somebody else, about this, it tends to get people into trouble. That if people do what they feel passionately about, they sometimes do the wrong things. They often do the wrong things. Usually do the wrong things. And the third one is how one manages the different views of the Ramban and the Rambam. How does one decide where one is going and which is the view one chooses? Go through the Sefer HaChinuch on these issues, all centered around the din of the Nazir, of the Nazirite. And the one principle that he says that we need to use, that we need to work with, is Ki b'heyot ba'olam Moshe HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'riyah meshutefet mechom v'sechol v'zehu Adam. Since there is in the world a being synthesized between intellect and material, Ayadava Royu Mechuyuv Kedelius Kilusa Baruchu Olei Yofim Ibriyosov, that it was a requirement of the perfection of praise of God. Sheim Ber Yazu Lo Yechesam Be'Olamot Kara Efsharut Sheyesh B'Da'atenu Lahasig, that together with this creation is created unlimited possibilities. And we discussed that in quite some detail, that there is no praise in choosing something you have no alternative about. But the only time that there is praise is if there is something else that is as attractive and you choose the one over the other. That means that then becomes a value statement. So you are then saying, I prefer A to B. So if a person is, for example, if you say to a person, would you like tea or coffee, and he says either, what is he really saying? I have no preference, which means I don't feel strongly about either of them. That's really what it means.
You can't mean like something?
No, you can't like everything. Yeah. See, that's a cop-out. When you like everything, then you really aren't making choices, and when you're not making choices, you're living in a very bland part of the world. Sure, you can like, but what do you feel like now? It doesn't make any difference. So then you try it out. You think, well, okay, would you like meat or fish? Doesn't make any difference. Do you want to marry that girl or that girl? Doesn't make any difference. And at what point does a person start saying, I feel like tea, I feel like coffee, I feel like meat, I feel like fish, or whatever it is? It's only when a person feels strongly about food and makes a choice. If a person says, I'll have tea, please, that doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't like coffee. And if he says meat, it doesn't mean that he doesn't like fish. All it means is that at this point, that's what he's choosing. He's choosing the one over the other. Where there's a choice, there is meaning in the, where there is attraction to more than one option, there is meaning to choosing one of the options. When there is no attraction to more than one option, then there is no meaning to the choice of one over the other. But choice is the way we express value. Choice is the way we say, to me, at this point, A is more important than B, or A is more valuable than B. So if you say to somebody, could you ever eat treif? And he says, treif, yuck! Then there's no real value in him eating kosher. I cannot, but of course he's doing nothing wrong by eating kosher, and that's valuable, that has something. But there's no choice in the process. If he says, true, would I love to eat trash? I've seen some trash food. I know what it smells like. I know what it tastes like. I know that there's nothing kosher that quite matches up. But what can I do? Can't. That's not, it's more important for me to keep the Torah and do the best we can under these circumstances. And that's fine. I didn't even put that correctly. That the approach would be much more, yes, I'm sure it would be delicious to have tray food, or I know that it's delicious to have tray food, but I enjoy the complete Torah and everything that it's involved in more than that. And so my choice is to keep kosher. That's a value statement. And that's why the Gemara says, the Mokum Shabbali Tshuva Umdim Entadikim Gemurim Yechurim Lamu, that where a Baal Tshuva stands, somebody who has lived the other life and has come to Torah, has a dimension that no completely righteous person has. And that's the dimension of choice. He has made the choice. He's been there and he's chosen not to do that, but to do something else instead. And what's important in that choice is that it's an ongoing process. When we say that the choice is not just a matter of, yes, 30 years ago I decided to become religious and I gave up eating trash. And so I've made that choice. That's also not the meaning. The meaning is that it's an ongoing choice. Every single day one makes a choice. And it works both ways. Every single day we say in our davening, we thank God who chose us. Why do we say it every single day? Why not just once in our life? Just recognize that 4,000 years ago, whenever it was, God chose us. Because God chooses us every day. It's not a choice, a one-off choice. A marriage should be the same. A marriage is not that 20 years ago I decided to marry so-and-so. I chose so-and-so. A marriage should be every day I choose so-and-so. In every single relationship in which one is, each thing should be a choice. I choose to be doing this now. I take responsibility for it. I'm making a choice. I'm making a value statement. That's why we make a brocha. A brocha is on everything we eat, on everything we do, is to bring to our attention the fact we are choosing to do it. We're choosing to do it at this particular time.
Yeah, but when we send our children to Jewish day school, the effect that we're doing is trying to limit choice.
Right.
We're saying choose kosher over trace. In fact, we're saying don't even consider trace. You should be kosher. We put it outside their purview, in part because we don't treat children, I think, like adults. I mean, they don't have the anchor yet.
To be able to make the choice.
Right. And yet we want them to be able to choose between good and evil. I mean, there are other kinds of choices we want to instill within them. So how do you reconcile that with this notion of choice that we as adults choose, we choose kosher and it's valuable because we decline trade? But for children, we're not creating that same play.
An important question, and comes into a lot of what gets discussed later, but let me deal with that right now, in the sense that you're limiting your child either way. If you send your child to a non-Jewish school, you're limiting your child. If you send your child to a Jewish school, you're limiting your child. If you raise your child not to eat treif, you're limiting your child. If you raise your child to eat treif, you're limiting your child. Because either way, you're establishing a norm from which a choice would have to be a deviation. And therefore, it doesn't help to say, well, I won't send my child to a Jewish day school and I will let him make the choice. Because you're making a choice by not sending the child, just as you would be by sending the child. So either way, the decisions a parent makes for a child during the earlier years of the child's life are decisions that are going to create the springboard from which the child is going to move forward, either positively or negatively. Teach your child not to be dishonest. Teach your child to be honest. You're limiting him. Teaching him to be dishonest, you're limiting him. So whatever we teach the child, we're limiting. And what we really need to try and teach the child is, yes, this is the way you do it. You start off, and your starting premise is, you carry on the value system that you got from your parents, and they from their parents, and they from their parents. That's your starting point. That's your anchor. That's where you feel most. If you choose to deviate from that, that's your choice. But that's your starting point, and that's the area of pride. And we will teach you why that's valuable. But we will also, in the process of teaching you that, not denigrate the value of other things outside of that framework. So we're not going to say to you, you must eat kosher because treif is yach. We had to say you must eat kosher because that makes God happy. And we'll discuss why that is so. Treif isn't yach, it's delicious. Most people in the world love it. And so probably would you if you ate it. But you still can't eat it. And my comments 2 and 3 weeks ago were that we're often not doing that, that we're trying to denigrate the alternative and create no alternative in the child's mind. That's not what we're developing. There was something else I wanted to comment on that question. It slipped my mind. I'm sure it'll come back to me. The Rambam differentiates between two types of prohibition. A prohibition where desiring it is an abnormality, and a prohibition where desiring it is normal. So if, for example, murder. To say I would love to murder, I would really enjoy it, it would be my best thing, but what can I do? God says no. That, says the Rambam, is an abnormality. That's not okay. To say I would love to eat a nice juicy piece of steak, but what can I do? God says no. That's normal. So he divides the prohibitions into those which intellect prescribes would be forbidden even if there wasn't a Torah, and those we shouldn't have any kind of craving for. And to have such a craving is already an aberration. Those mitzvahs which, if the Torah weren't given to us, we would never know we're wrong. There's nothing wrong with desiring. In fact, it's abnormal not to desire them. But the Torah says no. So once again, what's important is not to stifle the attraction to that which is wrong, but to stifle the translation of that attraction into action. Very much as we had in the Monday night show, with the fact that Shaul was not criticized for feeling sympathy for Amalek. That was not the problem. You can certainly feel sympathy for somebody you have to be cruel to. Not only can you feel sympathy for somebody you have to be cruel to, you should feel sympathy for somebody you have to be cruel to. If a parent has to discipline a child, a teacher has to discipline a student, they should feel sympathy. If they don't, they're cruel, they're harsh, they're callous. And so, the Torah very seldom restricts the way we feel about an issue. It restricts how we act on an issue, how we act on those feelings. Not everything we feel needs to be acted on, or needs to be acted on in the simple, spontaneous, childish sort of way. I want, therefore I'll do. I want? That's okay. You're entitled to want. Therefore what? Therefore nothing. I'll carry on wanting. That's the discipline that the Torah wants. Not how can you want such a thing. Now, in modern religious education, the tendency is, how can you want such a thing? And that creates enormous guilt feelings. And that starts inhibiting the development of the child and of the personality. Oh, you know what? I desired something that I'm not supposed to have. Isn't that a terrible thing? No, it's not a terrible thing at all. As long as that which you desired was not something which is abnormal. If that which you desired was normal, it's perfectly normal. Imagine how young people would grow up, and older people, if that was the emphasis. Knowing there's nothing abnormal about it, quite normal, that you can't translate it into action. Why not? Well, let's discuss why not. Everything has a reason why it's wrong to translate it into action. But the feeling itself is not abnormal. So here, God creates a human being with limitless possibility. Now, if the human being was created without the desire to do wrong things, there wouldn't be limitless possibility. Why would he want to do wrong? So part of limitless possibility is the desire for limitless things. This limitlessness, this desire for more, this enormous craving for things which are permitted and forbidden, is all part of the opening of opportunity. So God creates an individual with unlimited opportunity and moral instruction. So the fact that you have unlimited opportunity doesn't mean you can do what you want. That shows the power and the strength. You have the opportunity to do what you want. However, I'm instructing you to make choices, to limit certain things, to close certain doors, and to say, I can, but I won't, because I've chosen God's way, because I've chosen the Torah. That's the ideal that the Torah wants to cultivate. Now, the Chinuch goes on to develop the idea that Yeah, since man is created of these two parts, is the intellect and his and has his physical needs as well. It's necessary for man to engage in the maintenance of the physical world and his physical needs around him. It's a necessity. That's how we keep ourselves going. But we should be careful not to go too far in it. Therefore, he says, ideally, b'chol eis sheyuchal tichloi lema'et b'avodas achoymet. As far as one can limit one's mind from dealing in material things, v'yosei magamosoi la'avodas koinoi, and he can apply himself to the service of God, as tovloi, that's better for him. That's good for him. So the chinuch's approach is, there is this complex world, there is this limitless opportunity, you need to do certain physical things, and that's fine, that's okay, that's what God wants. How much involvement in the physical world? Only what you need. Yeah. What you need will vary from person to person. The Torah doesn't lay down the limit and say it's X number of calories of food, and it's X number of dollars in the bank, and it's, each person has to work out what he needs. And that, of course, is the difficulty. But to go beyond what you need in the physical world, says the chinuch, that's not. Rather apply yourself to spiritual things. Ubilvad shelo yitosh meleches habayis legamri vayachirivehu. Provided you are careful not to abandon your responsibilities in the physical world completely and destroy it. Ki gamze yechashev lo yovoin. Because that is also sin. To deny and to limit, not to limit, to deny and annihilate, destroy, reduce, that physical part of you which is a necessity, that is sin also. Because God wants this being that does live in both worlds. He doesn't want a being that's living in one world. He wants a being that is dealing with attention. He wants a being that is constantly making choices. And therefore you have to live in the physical world and choose the spiritual world. And that has to be every single day. You're living in the physical world and you're choosing the spiritual world. As it says in the Gemara, he says, "She'ein hayochid roshoy v'sagei patmoy b'tainis." You're not permitted to fast on days that aren't prescribed as fast days. Because the chinuch, you're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to limit yourself more than the Torah does. And the reason given, says the Gemara, because it says in Bereishis, "Vayehi ha'odom lenefesh chayo." The human being became a living being. Amra Torah, the Torah said, "Neshama shenosati b'cho hachayeh." That neshama, that soul that I've given to you, hachayeh, keep it alive. Now, it's in the interpretation of that posuk, of that verse, that we have the two schools beginning to diverge. What does it mean, keep it alive? Does it mean keep it in survival mode, make sure that it doesn't die? Or does it mean let it flourish? What does chayus mean? What does that life mean? It's very interesting that the brocha acharona, the blessing that we say after eating fruit and things like that, is very, very fascinating wording. And Tosfos and Brochus analyzes the wording. It goes, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam, Borei Nefoshos Chayos, the creator of living souls, the Chesroinon, and everything they require. L'Hachayos Bohem Nefesh Kol Chay. To give life with them to all living beings. So there's two statements here. There's providing, God provides everything we need for survival, and there's lahachayos bohem nefesh kol chai, to give life. And Tosfos explains what we're thanking God for is variety. What we're thanking God for is not that you can go to the pharmacy and buy the drugstore and buy vitamin tablets or vitamin tablets, that you can choose. You can get your vitamins from apples and oranges and tomatoes and bananas and pineapples, and you can choose. Just go to the marketplace, go to the fruit store, and see what's there and choose what you like, and that's the chayus, that's life. So there are two elements to chayus, to feeling alive. The one is survival. So you've got to make sure that you have enough nutrition, that you have enough money, that you have just what you need. That's survival, which is the way the chinuch is going. There is a second understanding of this concept, which is lahachayos, to give life to a soul means it should be vibrant. to give vibrancy to oneself. And vibrancy comes from variety. Vibrancy comes from choice. Vibrancy comes from diversity, from seeing lots of color, from seeing lots of, from tasting lots of different things, from experiencing lots of different things, from hearing lots of different things. That's what vibrancy comes from. Vibrancy doesn't come from narrowness. And now we've got the essential dichotomy, the Jewish dichotomy. If it all means just survival, then narrow yourself down to the absolute minimum, which is the one school of thought. If it means vibrancy, then narrowness destroys. The narrowness reduces. And you've got to expand. You've got to extend it. How do you do that? And this is the dichotomy that we deal with, which leads us on to the Nazir. What does the Nazir do? He says, for a month, I'm letting my hair grow, I won't have any wine, and he restricts himself and ends that period bringing a sacrifice, bringing a korban. And the chinuch asks, "Va'al tispaseini b'taim zeh," having developed this philosophy for you, says the chinuch, don't attack me asking, why did they say yoviyu kafora al asmo, that the nozir has to bring atonement, shetzir asmo min ayayin, because he limited himself from wine. The Gemara says that. So it says the chinuch, he realizes we're going to challenge him, and we're going to say, if it's so good to limit yourself, why does the nozir, after 30 days of limiting himself from one thing only, from nine, wine, have to bring a sacrifice? Now there are three answers. I've done two with you, but there are three. The one is his own. And he says he brings a sacrifice because he's afraid he might have overdone it. He might have limited himself for more than he should have. So you're walking this narrow line. It's correct to limit. It's correct to take from the world only what you need. But for these 30 days, maybe he went too far, so he brings a sacrifice. He then brings the Rambam's view, which is he did not go too far. He did wonderfully well. He's bringing a sacrifice because he's getting back, he's re-engaging in the world. So we're going to say, having limited yourself from wine, you have achieved a higher level of spirituality, and now you're going to get back into the world, and you're going to drop. Because with all of this, and this is all part of the amazing dichotomy, with all of this, there is a sense that the spiritual and the physical displace one another. That the more physical you have, the less spiritual. The more spiritual you have, the less physical. And that's why in Yom Kippur we can reach very high standards of spirituality. And we can feel it. We can actually feel the high standards of spirituality. It's much easier to do that. On the other hand, we have Purim, which is exactly the opposite, a day where we eat and we're merry and we drink. We do all sorts of physical things on Purim. And you know what the Ari says in Kabbalah, that Yom Kippur is called Yom Kippurim, which means a day almost as good as Purim, implying that there is greater spiritual value in what we can theoretically achieve on Purim than on Yom Kippur. Because there are two ways to achieve high spirituality. The one is to eliminate physical things and dedicate yourself to spiritual things, which is the way we go after death. That's why we can achieve spiritual heights after death that we cannot achieve in our lifetime, because there's now no physical distraction. We're completely spiritual. And on Yom Kippur, we simulate that. However, on Purim, we develop the ability to synthesize. And that gives us, in a way, an even higher spirituality than Yom Kippur. So one again sees this dichotomy, the Purim-Yom Kippur dichotomy. Yom Kippur is one kind of spirituality, Purim is another. Which is easier to achieve? Would you say, when's it easier to... Yom Kippur, it's much easier to be spiritual on Yom Kippur. And therefore the Ramban says, since he has chosen 30 days of non-physical involvement and raised himself to a Yom Kippur level, now that he's coming back into the physical world, he's got to atone for it. He's got to do it. He's not allowed to stay in Nazir for longer than 30 days, but he still brings an atonement to acknowledge to himself that what he's doing is really not the ideal. The ideal was where he was. The third view is the Rambam's view, which is exactly the opposite. The ideal is being engaged in the world. For a period of time, for certain reasons, he chose the Yom Kippur route. And that's okay, but he has to atone for it, because you're not supposed to choose that. Why do you choose that? You choose that because you think you've gone too far into the material world and you want to correct yourself. The Rambam has this view of balance, that life has to be balanced. And that's what the Torah requires. And when you shift, when you slip to one extreme, in order to bring yourself back to center, you sometimes have to move over to the other extreme. But it's wrong. It's not the ideal. You have to do it for medicinal purposes. You have to do it for curative purposes. And that's what the Nazir has done. He has moved off from center to one of the extremes and then has to bring a korban to atone for having done so. But as far as the Rambam is concerned, the ideal is the balance. So we've got in the one school of thought, the Ramban and the Chinuch, who hold that the ideal is spiritual without physical, but there's got to be a bit of physical, says the Chinuch. And we're afraid the Nozi might have gone too far into the spiritual world and abandoned the physical, so he brings an atonement. The Ramban who says, no, we're not worried about that, you can't go too far in spirituality. If you can cut out all the physical, that would be the greatest. The Ramban, for example, never went to a doctor. Right? He viewed, if I'm sick, that's from God, and God made me ill, and God will cure. That was his view. So the Ramban had a very extreme view in that any kind of physical involvement is concessionary, not ideal. Okay, from where the Christians get their view, it's not that the Ramban from the Christians, yeah, it's from where a certain part of Christianity. In other words, in Judaism there was such a school of thought, such a legitimate school of thought, school of the Ramban. The Rambam school is exactly the opposite. The Rambam school said God put us here as an ideal, not as a second thought. The ideal is that for the period of our life, he wanted us to synthesize the two, certainly after the sin of Adam. The way we live today, the way it is, it's an ideal to synthesize the two. Purim is the ideal. Purim is not the second best. Yom Kippur is the second best. And therefore, since the Inozir chose, for curative reasons, to go the Yom Kippur route for 1 month, that's something he was allowed to do, but it wasn't right, in a sense. Allowed to, but not right. And therefore, he brings the korban. Those are the three views as one sees them crystallized. This is a very beautiful law because in this law one sees all these schools focused in one place. The questions that we're asked, let's deal with Joanne's question from last time, and that is, what happens when it starts impinging on other people? So let me give you an example of how that's treated by the Rambam himself. Rambam says the chova, it is an obligation, al kol ish, on every man, lekan ois leishto, to feel passionate about his wife. Isn't that amazing? It's an obligation. He has to. How can you instruct passion? How can you say thou shalt be passionate? what does that mean? Well, firstly, yes, it means that he's got to be aware of the fact that is an obligation that he's gotten. And passion is something that one can cultivate and develop. It's not something that is just there or isn't there. Yes, sure, there is a kind of a reflex passion, but not, that's not necessarily the passion we're talking about. One has to develop and build, and as you value a person more, so that is able to develop. So firstly, there is that obligation. Secondly, one must assume it's an obligation upon him to marry somebody he can feel passionate about. And we discussed that 2 weeks ago. There's too much of a tendency in the shidduch business to just put two people together who've both got two eyes and both got a nose and a mouth and say, and you're both single and you're male and you're female, so what could be better? And you're both Jewish and you're not a Kohen and you're not a divorcee, and there's just no reason why you two shouldn't get together. And your age is about right as well, and just fantastic. That's not what it is. There's a chemistry too. And he's got to be sure that the woman he marries is somebody he is capable of feeling passionate about, and that he develops that passion.
He doesn't go the other way, does he?
No. She does not have to feel passionate about him. Okay. Yeah, it's not critical. Can, but it's not
did
critical.
You say that she has to respect him?
Yes. Mm-hmm. If she can't feel respect for him, his passion will not be valuable. Nobody is valued by a nobody who feels passionate about one. Anything that is valuable, so the two must go hand in hand. The passion, his passion for her is only valuable if she feels enormously respectful about him, otherwise it loses its dynamic. Which means she's got to marry somebody she respects. And so much goes wrong. I mean, there are many reasons why marriages go wrong. And they don't always mean that they were the wrong people to start with. Sometimes right people can also, all sorts of things can be. But one of them clearly is the non-recognition, and very much in the religious world today, of the need for those two dynamics. If she says, you know, it's true, I'm 38 and unmarried, but this guy that you're suggesting is 42 and unmarried, and does have two eyes and a nose and all the rest of it, I just don't respect him. There's nothing I can find that I can look up to. Don't push it. Why? What are you pushing? And you say, yeah, but he's crazy about you. But what difference does that make? or vice versa. There you are. She says, I really think he's great, but he says, you know, I just don't feel anything for it. We've been out a few times. There's no spark. Don't push it. Drop it. Leave it. There's no point in pushing people together. Unless they get together just for company and they decide, you know, we're not really married. I don't respect you and you're not passionate about me, but we're both lonely, so let's live together. That's not a marriage. But if one's trying to create a marriage, those two dynamics need to be there.
But what about, I mean, there are situations that I've known of in my life and people where they've just been thrown together for a long time, like on a ship or whatever, and they didn't like each other at all at first. And after a long time, they just really started to like each other.
They're very lucky. They're very lucky. I wouldn't like to be responsible for that, for a shidduch like that. Because it's, you know, it's lucky it turned out right, and if it turned out wrong, unless they know what they're doing, they're going in with the eyes open, and then the chaplain says, you know, you don't feel much about her, and she doesn't respect you much, but maybe it'll grow. But you better say maybe. Sometimes people are naive, and they get into things because some rabbi has said, you know, your names match. Good marriage. Good idea, you know. It's absurd. This is a physical relationship. This is not, out of the physical relationship grows the spiritual. But it's not a spiritual relationship out of which grows the physical. It's a physical relationship out of which grows the spiritual. So it's got to be established physically. You like her. Do you admire him? Right, there's something to work on. She says, I'm not wildly attracted to him physically. That doesn't matter. One can still work, provided the basics are there. But there needs to be, he needs to find her very attractive, and she needs to find him really amazing as a human being. And then you've got the foundation. Without that, there's no foundation. Nothing at all. And marriages often go wrong where, for one reason or another, that gets lost. He stops finding her attractive, or she stops respecting him. And then you can try and patch and patch and patch, and they might decide to stay together, but because they're children and this and that and the other, that the dynamic is gone. And that has to be preserved, and it's not easy. Omr Chachomim, the rabbi said, that in fact it's a level of purity to feel passionate about one's wife, because one doesn't normally feel passionate about something or someone who's readily available. One normally feels more passionate about people and things that are not readily available. So it is a level of purity that comes. It is one of the wonders of the world that one can sustain passion in a marriage. And there's purity in that. There's greatness in that. So you see here the Rambam thinking, in a sense, the greatness is not in saying passion is not important. You follow, it's not in saying, it doesn't matter, I've got my wife and I don't feel anything for any other woman. That's not the greatness, that's not the purity. The purity is that a man's passion is fulfilled within his marriage, even though that's where the familiarity exists. However, here comes your point, Jaron, the lawyer kanelo beyotze midai, but don't be too passionate. What is the level of, how can one be too passionate? But you see, you can. So in our discussion of passion and lust, there is already a concept that the Rambam introduces of too much. What is too much? The lo ya'anoisei so, that he does not rape her, his own wife. Their relationships have to always be one in which she is seduced, not forced. So his passion has to be something that doesn't deprive him of the ability to engage the other person in her own will rather than impose on the other person. And that starts giving us some idea as to where that boundary line is. That when passion becomes one that leads to force in any area, then one's on to an animal passion. Where passion is one that leads to persuasion, then one is on to a human passion. So if you find that I come along and I look at your house and I say, that's a beautiful house, I would love that house. I know the Torah says I'm not supposed to love somebody else's, but I love that house. Well, that's not a house, let's say your beautiful necklace there that you're wearing, a beautiful piece of jewelry. Now, and I'm totally passionate about it now, I just can't take my eyes off it, I've got to have it. Now, two options. What do I do with this passion? The one is I start persuading you to sell it. Have you thought of selling it, and you know what you could do with it, and then I persuade you to sell it. The other is I rip it off your neck and run. They're both acts of passion. The human passion, the passion that Torah encourages, is the passion that leads to persuasiveness. And passion and persuasiveness lies in passion. One can persuade when one feels passionate about an issue. When one does not feel passionate about an issue, it's much harder to persuade. And in the in human relations, it's exactly the same. If your passion is leading you to persuade somebody else into an action that you're passionate about, that's fine. They have choices too. If your passion leads to force somebody else into an action that you're passionate about, that does not leave them choices, and that isn't okay. That isn't fine. And that becomes the boundary line of violence and passion. The issue of how do you choose and what do, and what's it all about, leaving aside the Ramban, who takes it as almost an ideal, that the less you can have to do with the physical world, the better, because that's the choice. The ultimate choice is complete sacrifice of the physical world, if you can, but not to the point of death, just to minimum requirements. If you can do that, that's the ultimate choice. And the view of the Rambam and others, where the ideal choice is the balance, is the synthesis of these different worlds. What does one choose for oneself? The Ramban's direction is for the limited few. That's not something that anybody that you or I know of in our generation would or should contemplate following. Ramban de Vilna Gaon followed that route. That's for a person who is able to satisfy all of his or her needs emotionally, physically, spiritually, in every way, in the world of intellect, in the world of spirituality. So it's not deprivation. It's not deprival. That's what's important, and we're not there. So let's leave aside the Ramban, but there's the Chinuch's own view, which is, yes, you need to do certain other things, and you're not allowed to abandon them, so you need to go to work, you need to have a home, you need to have clothes, you need to do all these things, and that's fine and okay, and do them. Just not more than you need. Just limit the amount as far as you can. The element that you need to throw into this discussion is the element called Yirat Shemayim, or Yirat Hashem. What does Yirat Hashem mean? Fear of God. Right? Or more specifically, Yirat Chesed, the fear of sin. And this will be the argument of those people who follow this route, and it's a very valid argument. And they say, sin to us is something so dangerous, something so real, something so capable of destroying everything that's precious to us, that we will do anything to keep far away from it. And engagement in the world is just too dangerous. That will be their view. And just as there are people who don't want to become radiographers because they're too closely in touch with radiation, there are people who don't want to work in a nuclear plant, there are people who don't want nuclear power stations in their towns. They don't deny that it's incredible power. They don't deny that it's the most efficient form of energy and the cleanest form of energy. They just don't want the risk. That's the argument that these people would put in. Just say, you know, you're right. It would be great if we could create the synthesis, but I don't trust myself to be able to create that synthesis in our current environment. Let us look, for example, at some of the laws that are designed to achieve that synthesis. If you look at the way Jewish society used to be structured, there was a very limited, taken in the intersexual relationships, there was a very limited mixing of the sexes in Jewish society. So women weren't in business. Women generally stayed at home, and if they did some work, they did it at home. If they went out, if there was a simcha, if there was a party, it was separate. If there was shul, anywhere where people mixed. Sure, in most places. In Lithuania, but Lithuania goes the Rambam through, but in most other places, and even in Lithuania in many places, it was separate. And shul, so whenever people gathered together, men and women were separate. The only place that men and women met were at home. There was nowhere else. The women went shopping, the men didn't. The men went to work, the women didn't.
The men were shopkeepers, no? Who was the shopkeeper?
That's interesting. Men were shopkeepers very often, and there was interaction. You're right. And the Gemara says, in fact, that certain types of businesses men shouldn't go into in those times, such as the perfumeries and things like that, which is really where your clientele is primarily female and you're dealing in the feminine area of her femininity, for that very reason that creates opportunity.
Not that women were shopkeepers?
Some were, but many of the men were shopkeepers. Some of the women were shopkeepers. And then the women would have been the customers, and some women would have gone to women shopkeepers and so on. So there was very little mixing of the sexes except at home, in the home environment. And in the home environment, the woman was princess, she was queen. So even if there was mixing, even if you invited families over to your house, in that house, the whole way it was structured was your own structure. And so it didn't in any way undermine that kind of relationship. That allowed, now you might look at that and say that's very restrictive, but what that allowed was for people to be free with their passions. You didn't have to turn your passion on and off and say, the Rambam says I must be passionate about my wife, so I'm going home, passion on. Now I'm leaving home and I'm going to work and there are women around at work, passion off. Because if passion's on, and then that's really bad because I'm hours and hours I'm at work and so better turn passion off. So the Torah's ideal society was structured in a way where the society looks restrictive and is, enabling the human being to liberate. And for example, the laws of Yichud, don't be alone with a woman in a situation of privacy. What is that saying? Is that restrictive? Sure, it's restrictive, but what does that mean? Again, I don't have to be turning on and off and saying, I'm alone with her and she's incredibly attractive, but I can't touch her. You're not put in that situation. All those laws are designed not to have to inhibit the passion. Just don't put yourself in a situation where you might have to inhibit the passion. That way you can leave the passion in its place to do what it's meant to do. Now when that was society, then it was easy to operate. This school of thought will argue that now that that is not society, I've got to limit myself and I've got to remove myself and I've got to, because I just cannot successfully engage in life without running the risk of doing something wrong, and I'm just not prepared to take that risk. That's that argument. Judy?
It still goes against the idea you were discussing earlier about the value of choices.
True.
When you have choices.
True. And I say you're right, and I wish it weren't like that, but if it's a question of having daily choices or my daily choice is disengagement because of fear of sin, that's a choice. That means sin is more serious a possibility to me than the gain of having all these choices.
Right, but the time that you're talking about, the time before, when the society was structured in such
right.
a way,
so less choice.
There was far less choice, so you wonder how passionate can you feel when there was no other choice, right? Because you were saying that the value is...
You're right. Society was created in order to enable you to be free with your passion, whatever passion it was, with limited risk of going off the tracks. Now we're living in an opposite society, where it's hardly possible to stay on the track. One is just bombarded with so much opportunity and choice and attractiveness, very, very hard to stay on the track. And you've got a school of today, the majority of religious people in the right camp, who move off and say, we choose disengagement, we choose to create our own societies. And so we've created our own societies in New York and in Yerushalayim and a few other places where we can live freely and let ourselves be without the fear of engagement. The other school of thought says, no, I'm not willing to completely cut away everything that makes me who I am. I've got to engage. I've got to be part of the world. That's how I grow. That's how I develop my personality. Choices, yes, I've got to make choices all the time. Easy route, no. Am I going to slip up every now and again? Sure I did. So did King David. So did Moshe. So did lots of people. Sure I'm going to slip up. I'm going to try and slip up as little as I can. And when I do slip up, I'll try and fix it. But I'm not going to disengage.
You're trying to recreate the way it was, really.
Well, it's making Adam's choice, in a sense, all over again. I want the greatness of being able to choose. I want to understand options and make my choices. Does that limit my possibility? Does that increase the possibility of sin? Yes, but I like living on the edge. That's really the two types: the human being who wants the safety, and the human being says, "I want to live on the edge." And sometimes it means I'm going to fall and catch myself, and I might even die. But that's what makes it exciting. And I'm going to try not to. I'm going to try and do as best I can. But that's what energizes me. That's what keeps me going. And that's the choice he makes. What's important for us to understand in this is the legitimacy of both schools of thought. that one cannot say there's only one route. It's perfectly legitimate for a person to say, I'm just terrified of sin. And it's perfectly legitimate for a person to say, I'm just terrified of atrophication, of just becoming nothing. And God didn't put me here to become nothing. And therefore, if God has made allowed the world to get into its current state, I'll do the best I can to impact on it, to improve it, to change it, to protect myself, to build myself, to build my family. And we'll slip up occasionally, we'll do our best, but we're going to live a normal life. We're going to engage in a normal way. That's our choice. In both cases, trying as hard as we can to keep to the Torah. But one in an environment of exclusiveness and one in an environment of openness. Those are the two choices. If you remind me next week, before we go on back to the Chumash, which we'll begin to do next week, I'll just deal with modern Orthodoxy and where that fits in.